People all around the world have different views about who God is. Different religions, different people. But at the end of the day, God, capital G, is God. We don't make God. God made us. He is who he is, regardless of what some religion says, some politician, some preacher, some celebrity. At the end of the day, part of what defines God is he is God. He is who he is. He is in charge, he is sovereign, and he ultimately wins. Now, this big sovereign theology of God has great comfort. It's the basis by which we as believers believe at the end of the day, God wins, God triumphs, God keeps his promises. God will deliver us to the new heaven and the new earth, everything that our souls long for. That's all part of a big God theology. But it comes with some struggles. If God is so big, if God is sovereign, if God is so strong, what do you do with evil in the world? What do you do with pain and suffering? What do you do with this tragedy in my life? And it does create difficult discussions, lots of questions without answers. But it's also helpful to think of it this way. Okay, what if God wasn't big and sovereign? So what if evil and suffering in the world was just random? What if it has no meaning and purpose? What if life is just like the lottery and you chose a bad lottery ticket and your life is filled with tragedy? I'm sorry about that. It has no meaning and purpose. That's just the way it goes. How is that more comforting? How is that better? At the end of the day, at least we can know that even though we don't have answers for our pain and our struggles, at the end of the day, there is meaning and purpose. God is still in charge. God is somehow working out his promise. It's also true that there is both good and bad to this big God theology, in the sense that if I'm like Saul, and I am determined to rebel against God, I'm determined to be my own God, I'm determined to do it my own way, at the end of the day, I can't win. You simply can't fight God and win. This came up last week when Saul called Samuel back from the dead, and Samuel actually said to Saul, "You have made God your adversary. You cannot fight God and win." On the good side is the reminder that not only on my good days, in my good seasons, when I'm on track and doing everything well, but also in those times when I am acting out of my self-sufficiency, I'm acting out of my own strengths, when I end up making a huge mess of things, God doesn't abandon me, but God is still there, silently, quietly orchestrating events for my goodness in order to work out this mess and somehow superintend a way out. And that's what we want to talk about this morning. If you have a Bible, turn with us to 1 Samuel chapter 29. If you're visiting with us, we've been working our way through 1 Samuel. We're getting right to the end of the book. These last chapters get a little bit confusing because they're not in chronological order. That can kind of get confusing. So, for example, the events in chapter 29 that we talk about today actually preceded the events of chapter 28 that we talked about last week. The reason for that is the writers aren't always interested in just recording history day by day. They're interested in developing theology through the retelling of history. So sometimes the chapters are reorganized in order to develop theological themes. I think in this case, the writer inviting us to draw comparisons between Saul and David here at the end of the book. Last we saw David, the first two verses of chapter 28, and in the story in chapter 27, David was acting out of his self-sufficiency. I think David was well-intended. I think David's confused. I think he's hurt. I think he's struggling in the wilderness. But I think he has a heart for God. He's wanting to do the right thing. He's a warrior. He's a leader. He's taking charge. But he's doing it himself in his own strength. Now he's got himself in a big mess. He has departed from the land of Israel. He's in the land of the Philistines. He's been there almost a year and a half. He's won the favor of King Achish. And now the Philistines are going to war against the Israelites. And Achish wants David and his men to fight with him against the Israelites. Not only David and his men are involved, but they have families. Most scholars guess between 1,500 and 3,000 people back home at Ziklag. So if David chooses to fight against the Israelites with the Philistines, this will be the battle where Saul and his sons will die. And how does then David step up to be the king of Israel when he fought with the Philistines against his own people? But if he chooses to turn on Achish and the Philistines, it's most likely then that the family members back at Ziklag will all be slaughtered. So it seems like there is virtually no way out for David. That's where we left him. We pick up chapter 29, verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, while the Israelites were camping by the spring which is in Jezreel. And the lords of the Philistines were proceeding on by hundreds and by thousands. And David and his men were proceeding on in the rear with Achish. Then the commanders of the Philistines said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" And Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, "Is this not David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, who has been with me these days, or rather these years? And I have found no fault in him from the day that he deserted to me to this day." But the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him, and the commanders of the Philistines said to him, "Make the man go back, that he may return to his place where you have assigned him, and do not let him go down to battle with us, or in the battle he may become an adversary to us. For with what could this man make himself acceptable to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of these men?" So David is with Achish, and they are all moving to Aphek in order to gather, and then they'll go about another 40 miles further north to the valley of Jezreel, where the battle will take place. Aphek was kind of a gathering ground. It may be a little bit familiar. If you go all the way back to early in the book, in the third chapter, it was when the Philistines and the Israelites were at war with one another. Eli and his sons were still alive. Israel was losing. Eli's sons got the bright idea of taking the Ark of the Covenant into battle. Israel's defeated. The Ark is captured. It's one of the real dark moments in 1 Samuel. All of that happened at Aphek. So now here they're gathering there. It makes sense that Achish and David and the troops are bringing up the rear. There's five major Philistine cities, all of them on the coastal plains. Gath would have been the farthest to the south. Ziklag is south of that yet. So they're basically the last ones to arrive. There were five Philistine lords or kings leading the five major cities. The commanders would be the generals. And the commanders see David and his men, and they don't want them there. Achish stands up for David. David's transferred his loyalty. David now is with us. And he clearly stands up and defends David. But the commanders will have none of it. They just don't trust David. They want David and his men sent home. There is this reminder that it is possible that in the midst of the battle, that David and these Israelites could turn on them. There is also this reminder that there's probably no better way for David to gain the favor of Saul again than by coming back to Saul with the heads of these Philistines. So David's up to something. They don't trust him. They're angry with Achish, and they want David sent back. The reference to David coming with the heads of the Philistines certainly takes us as readers back to the story of David and Goliath. Goliath was from Gath. He was their champion. David was a young shepherd boy. He trusted God. God gave him a great victory. It's been one of the highlights in the David story. So David's done this before when he cut off the head of Goliath, and that was his trophy. And so they're referencing back that we don't want this guy fighting among us. The idea that it's hinting, the text is hinting back to the David and Goliath story is reinforced then in verse 5. Is this not David of whom they sing in the dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? This is the third time the lyrics of this song have come up in the Samuel text. The first time was chapter 18, after David had defeated Goliath. The people fell in love with him. David trusted God. God was giving David one victory after another. If you remember, Saul put him in charge of the special forces. He was defeating the Philistines. He was winning victory after victory after victory. We would say so far in the David story, that's probably been the highlight for David in terms of his victories in Israel. But all of that so threatened Saul. That David was a better warrior. David was a better leader. The people are falling in love with David. And then these women started singing this song about Saul killing 1,000, David killing his 10,000s. And even though that was a great moment for David, it was the beginning of his nightmare. It's really helpful to get into David's head to remember David had done nothing other than trust God. As a shepherd boy, he defeated Goliath. He was defeating the Philistines. He was trusting God with remarkable faith, and his reward for that is his life has turned into a nightmare, and it started with the lyrics of this song. Saul determined that David would take the throne, so David must die. The second time the lyrics of this song were uttered was again among the Philistines. Before Achish, when David all by himself left and went to Gath, thought maybe he could hide out there early in his fleeing from Saul, but the commanders saw him, they recognized David, they quoted this song, and they were fearful of David being among them. That's when David thought if Achish recognizes him, then he'll kill him. So David pretended to be insane, was apparently quite convincing, was drooling down his beard, and basically Achish said, you know, the guy's crazy. I don't need another crazy man in the city. It wasn't exactly David's finest hour. So now we're almost a decade later. Again, David is in the land of the Philistines. David again is acting out of his self-sufficiency. David again has got himself in a mess with Achish. And again, the lyrics of the song come up, that this is David of whom they sang. I think the reason for the song coming up in both of these Philistine events is to remind the reader, as well as reminding David, that when he trusted God, God did amazing things. He was just a little shepherd boy, and he toppled the great giant. The whole basis for the lyrics of the song was David was trusting God. God was giving him great victories. But now David is acting in his own strength, in his own self-sufficiency. Now he's made a mess of things. So again, the lyrics remind us of what God can do when David trusts him. Verse 6, then Achish called David and said to him, As the Lord lives, you have been upright, and your going out and your coming in with me in the army are pleasing in my sight. For I have not found evil in you from the day of your coming to me to this day. Nevertheless, you are not pleasing in the sight of the Lord's. Now therefore, return and go in peace, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines. So Achish immediately comes to David's defense. Now, previously in the chapter, when Achish defended David to the commanders, there's probably something within us that's a little uncomfortable with that, because we know David hasn't actually been operating as a man of integrity. He has told Achish that he's been going out from Ziklag to attack cities in Judah. Achish even said, David's made himself odious to Saul and the Israelites. This is why he's convinced there's no way David would go back to Israel. But David has been lying. David has actually been attacking the allies of the Philistines down in southern Judah, basically cleaning up that area so when he becomes king, that will be dealt with. But he reports back to Achish and lies through his teeth again and again and again. And in order to protect his lies, to make sure nobody gives him away, he's had to kill men and women who could possibly be witnesses to tell Achish otherwise. So David hasn't really been conducting himself with integrity. He hasn't really been loyal to Achish. Achish is just deceived. So now we have kind of this uncomfortable feeling in our gut because this is now getting really messed up. Notice when Achish called David and said to him, "As the Lord lives, you have been upright." Lord, capital L-O-R-D, is the Hebrew Yahweh. This is extremely unusual that a Philistine pagan king is actually offering an oath in the name of Yahweh. What's going on here? Is it possible that because Achish now has been so influenced by David and his strength and his integrity and his loyalty, that he actually has some belief in David's God, Yahweh? It's hard to know. We could say, at the very least, he, as a Philistine, has a high respect for Israel's God, for David's God, Yahweh. So he actually offers an oath in the name of Yahweh. The oath has to do with David's integrity. He's specifically referring to David going out and coming in. We've talked about that's Hebrew language for going to war. He is specifically referring to David's integrity in the battles he's fought. So again, as readers, we have this uncomfortable feeling because we know that's not true. We know David hasn't had integrity. We know that he's lying. We know that he's deceiving Achish. And now Achish seems to have some level of respect for David's God, and this is all just getting more and more messed up. David responds in verse 8. David said to Achish, "But what have I done? And what have you found in your servant from this day, when I came before you to this day, that I may not go to fight against the enemies of my Lord the king?" So David responds, "What have I done that the commanders, the generals, won't let me go with you to fight against Israel?" So now this is again getting all messed up. This is the fourth time that David has uttered these words, "What have I done?" But this is the first time that they don't ring true. The first time that David uttered these words was to Eliab, his brother. You remember when David, the shepherd boy, came up to the front, listened to Goliath utter his threats, wondered, "Who is this Philistine windbag, and why doesn't somebody deal with him?" And Eliab, his brother, went off on David and accused him of all kinds of things that weren't true. And David said, "What have I done? I'm just asking a question." He was completely innocent in that moment, had a high level of integrity. The second time was with Jonathan, when Saul was trying to kill David. And David said to Jonathan, "What have I done? I've been loyal. I've been faithful. What have I done?" Again, David was right. He had operated with the highest degree of integrity. Third time was with Saul himself after the cave incident. "What have I done that you're trying to kill me? I've been loyal to you in every way." And Saul affirmed that. Those three times, David was operating with the highest degree of integrity. But this fourth time, it's very different. David is acting. David is playing some sort of a game. What has he done? Actually, quite a bit. He has deceived Achish. He's lied to Achish. He's killed the witnesses. Just because he says, "What have I done?" doesn't mean he's innocent. It's like people today that say, "I'll let my integrity speak for itself." It's like, well, sometimes it does, and you don't have any. Just because you say that line doesn't mean suddenly you have integrity. In this case, we're just getting uncomfortable. David's gotten himself in such a mess, and he just keeps digging, and it seems like there's no good way out. It's going to involve the lives of thousands of people, including people's view of Yahweh, his God. The last line, verse 8, is discussed a lot by commentators when David says, "That I may not go and fight against the enemies of my Lord, the king." So what is he actually saying? If you just take the plain reading of the text, David is saying that Achish is his king and that he wants to go with Achish, his king, to fight the enemy, and the enemy is Israel. But there's some commentators that just can't go with that. So they say, well, David's actually really talking about God as his king, and he's going to fight the Philistines. Others say, well, he's actually kind of being sneaky with a double meaning, and he's actually referring to Saul as his king, and the enemy are the Philistines. But there's no moral way out of that, because to do that, he has to betray the trust of Achish, whom he's lied to. It's just a mess every way you look at it. I think just the normal, straight reading of the text is correct. It's another lie. He is pretending to be loyal to Achish. He's pretending that he wants to go. He's pretending when he gets there, he will kill Israelites. It's hard to imagine that's David's intention. I think probably the most likely is when he gets there, he'll turn on Achish, but that has its own moral issues to wrestle with. What I think the point of the text is David is in a mess, and he's getting deeper and deeper in the mess. It seems like there's just no way out. But Achish replied to David, "I know that you are pleasing in my sight, like an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, 'He must not go up with us into battle.' Now then, arise early in the morning with your servants of your Lord who have come with you, and as soon as you have arisen early in the morning and have light, depart." So David arose early, he and his men, to depart in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines. And the Philistines went up to Jezreel. Basically, I think at this point, Achish actually fears for David and his men. The commanders are not going to let him go. They're angry. They're not going to put up with it. And at first light, David, gather your men and go home before something bad happens. So David ends up going home. You can see the sovereignty of God working through the Philistine generals and creating a way where David could get out of this mess, back home, family safe, before the Philistine army goes up to Jezreel. And then the events in chapter 28 happen when Saul sees them. And then chapters 30 and 31 basically are happening simultaneously. And we'll get to those in the next couple of weeks. It's interesting to see the sovereignty of God. As David, through his self-sufficiency, has gotten himself into a mess where it seemed like there's no way out. And yet God orchestrates events in such a way that David is able to get back home safely, the families are not killed, and the army moves forward. David has no idea at this point in the story that part of what God is sovereignly up to is David desperately needs to get back to Ziklag as quickly as possible because there is something there very serious he needs to attend to. What is that? We'll find out next week. As we begin to look at these two stories, the David story and the Saul story, what makes them so different is not that Saul messed up and David didn't. It's not that Saul sinned and David didn't. It's that at the core, Saul was rebelling against God. The text told us early on, Saul did not have a heart for God. He did not want to obey God. He didn't want to do it God's way. He wanted to do it his own way. He wanted to function as his own God. And as Samuel told him in last week's text, you can't fight God and win. You've made God your adversary. The David story is very different. The very basis by which David was chosen is David has a heart for God. David wants to walk in obedience. David wants to be God's king. David wants to do this right. But David has a lot to learn. You might say, you know, if David had a heart to God, you know, he sure messed up a lot. And I would say, exactly. Which is why he needed a decade in the wilderness school of leadership. If David understood all this stuff, if David always did everything right, if David understood this perfectly, he didn't need 10 years in the wilderness. The whole point is David needed 10 years in the wilderness through pain and suffering and struggles and disappointments and heartaches to refine, to formulate, to grow his character in order to prepare him for his assignment. It is true that David will become the greatest king in the history of Israel. But that would not have been possible had he not spent 10 years in the wilderness school of leadership. He had to learn about brokenness. He had to learn about surrender. He had to learn about God's part and his part. He had to learn to be a great leader. He has to be a faithful follower. There are so many lessons that David had to learn in order that he would be a great king in Israel. When you read through the scriptures, this is a familiar pattern. The great leaders spent time in the wilderness. Whether you're talking about Abraham, whether you're talking about Moses, whether you're talking about Joseph, whether you're talking about David, whether you're talking about Elijah, whether you're talking about Paul, whether you're talking about Peter, that is God's training ground to grow us, to refine us. Peter talks about the fires burn away the impurities and they refine us and they grow us and they change us. The problem is we don't like that. We just want to believe somehow I can be ready without time in the wilderness. This is especially true of us as American Christians. Historically through the world, and even in most places in the world today, there was a strong sense that life is hard. It is filled with pain and suffering. That's part of the story. It will always be part of the story because we live in a sin-cursed world. And there was an understanding that pain and suffering made us stronger made us better. And there was a whole theology that God uses this to burn away the impurities and to grow us and to make us more like him. But in America, life has become so easy by the standards of history. It is so sanitized. It is so happy. It's so pleasant. It's so quiet that this has dramatically affected our theology. Where else could anyone come up with a theology that the gospel is about health, wealth, and prosperity, except in a place like modern America, where we think that's what God wants for you? If you're a good Christian, if you're a good boy, if you're a good girl, then everything's supposed to work out. That's the deal. And so we as Americans kind of form our theology around that. And what happens is we have no basis to process pain and suffering. It's an interruption in the plan. This isn't the way it was supposed to be. I was supposed to be a good boy. You were supposed to make everything work out. And that was the deal. And God says, there is no deal. God didn't make that deal. As a matter of fact, the scriptures couldn't be more clear from the beginning. This is going to be hard. It's going to be filled with struggles and trials and pain and suffering. That's what the road will look like. There's nowhere where the scriptures say, let's make a deal. You be a good preacher and everything will work out. No pain and suffering. Everything will make sense. There has to be an understanding when that's my theology, I'm not really pursuing God. I'm pursuing the best deal. And that's a very selfish pursuit. And we set ourselves up for pain and disappointment when we think I'm being really good. I'm following the rules. I'm doing what I'm supposed to. And now God betrayed me. God let me down. And we're saying, God, you didn't keep your end of the deal. And God is saying, what deal? I didn't make that deal. Really trusting God is a choice of your will. You decide, I'm going to choose to trust God. I'm going to choose to believe God is who he says he is. For me and my own personal story is something I settled years ago after years and years of struggling with this, is I choose to believe God is who he says he is. I do trust him with all my heart. I believe he's good and he's faithful and he's kind and he's loving and he's just. I believe that. I believe it on my best days and I believe it on my worst days. Some days it's easy to believe, and some days it takes everything I have to believe, but it's a choice of my will. I choose to believe. And God meets me in that belief, and he reminds me again and again that he's good, and he's faithful, and he's loving, and he's kind. If your theology is, I want a ride on the love boat, I just want to follow the rules, and I want God to make sure that everything works out. It's smooth sailing. You're setting yourself up for devastation and hurt. It's just not going to be like that in a sin-cursed world. There has to be a sense in which this is not a deal. I just choose to trust God, and I need him to meet me in my hour of sorrow and need and question and disappointment and remind me again and again who he is. Next week, we're going to talk more about this as we wrap up the David story. But here's what I would give you just to process this week. What is your theology? If your theology is, I want a ride on the love boat. I want to do what God asked me to do, and in return, I want smooth sailing. I want a ride on the love boat. You need to understand, first of all, you're setting yourself up for disappointment, which then turns to anger and bitterness, which is a good way to waste life. The other way to view it is to understand I have been put here on purpose for a purpose. God has assigned me a mission. Everything that my soul longs for is yet to come in the new heaven and the new earth. Right now, this is a battleground. This isn't a playground. This isn't heaven. This is war. And I've been given an assignment, and I want to live my life for the things that matter. I have one shot to invest myself in things that will still matter 100,000 years from now. And I don't want to miss that. But in order to be prepared to fulfill my assignment, it is likely I will have to spend times in the wilderness school of leadership. God has to change me. He has to grow me. He has to break me. He has to refine me. He has to do what is necessary to prepare me to fill my assignment. If you're going to be serious about this Jesus thing, if you're going to be serious about being a Christ follower, if you're going to be serious about saying, I want my life to matter, you have to understand pain and suffering is a part of the story that's necessary to prepare you, to refine you, to grow you, to strengthen you, to do something great that will matter forever. What you think about these theologies will in large part determine how well you handle the most difficult moments of life. Our Father, this morning we celebrate that you love us. Lord, for some in the room this morning, those are easy words to hear. For others, they are just really hard. Because sometimes the circumstances of life are just so hurtful and so confusing. God, give us the courage and the faith and the strength we need to trust you in the worst of days and to believe somehow there is a plan and purpose and that the days that our souls long for are yet to come in the new heaven and the new earth. God, made possible through the death, burial, and resurrection of your own Son. God, give us the faith to trust you in Jesus' name. Amen.